Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And the first order of business will be to call the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Backlund.
Backlund present.
Backer.
Backer present.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman. Bierman. Bolden.
Present.
Damoth.
Damoth present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Bernhagen.
Present.
Keel. Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison present.
Munson.
Munson present.
Pryor.
Present.
Palm.
Present.
Ryer.
Ryer present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. So the next order of business is to approve the minutes from March 19th. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Madam Chair, so moved.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Vice Chair Hewitt moves approval of the minutes of March 19th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes of March 19th, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. All right, we will go right into our first bill today, and that is Representative Morrison's House File 2113. Representative Morrison, would you like to move your bill? And that would be to be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill.
Yes, I would, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Morrison. And you have an author's amendment. Did you want to move that now, the A1 amendment?
Yes, please. I would like to move the A1 amendment.
All right. So let's move the A1 and members, if we can adopt that to get the bill in the order in which the author would like to discuss it, and then we can go through the bill as amended. All those in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 is adopted. All right, Representative Morrison, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Representative Zhang and I thank you for the opportunity to present House File 2113 as co-authors today. Minnesota has struggled with chronic racial disparities in healthcare access and outcomes for years, and the COVID-19 pandemic has laid bare and exacerbated those inequities. We know that BIPOC communities have been hit harder by the pandemic in terms of infections and deaths. We urgently need to do better in getting the vaccines to these communities. This bill attempts to address the vaccine equity issue and suggests some immediate changes to expedite that process. The bill also aims to build up our public health infrastructure so that we can better address the inequities in our healthcare system and so that we are ready for the next pandemic. I want to thank MDH and Commissioner Malcolm for their work over this past year and for their willingness to partner, their willing partnership to address some of our challenges and shortcomings. I also want to thank my friend and co-author, Representative Jay Zhang, and the rest of the Posse Caucus for their leadership. And to my colleagues in the medical community, several of whom you will hear from today, who have pushed us all to do better. With that, I will turn it over to Representative Zhang.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Welcome to the committee, Representative Zhang. We don't get to see you here enough, but good to see you. Please go ahead and help introduce the bill.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I want to thank you, Chair Liebling, and our chief author, Representative Morrison, Majority Leader Winkler, our Posse Chair Samantha Vang, Vice Chair Holden Hassan, and our 30 other colleagues who co-authored this bill, and leadership staff for making this hearing possible today. I'm proud to co-author and co-present the bill, which will take on the issue of one of the last major frontiers of medicine, and that is health equity. In a global pandemic, our historical systems have shown their weaknesses and the ways in which they have not always lived up to their promises. This pandemic shines a powerful light on the horrific toll of unchecked racial inequities. COVID-19 hospitalizations and deaths have been disproportionately higher for our BIPOC communities than any other racial groups. The Center for Disease Control defines health equity as, and I quote, health equity is achieved when everyone, every person has the opportunity to attain his or her full health potential, and no one is disadvantaged from achieving this potential because of social position or other socially determined circumstances. Health inequities are reflected in differences in length of life, quality of life, rates of disease, disability, and death, severity of disease, and access to treatment, end quote. It's therefore my honor and great pleasure to advance a bill which tackles the heart of our issue and helps better capture the necessary metrics of our work, holds accountable the stated resources of our life-saving medical delivery systems, and most importantly, continue saving the lives of millions of Minnesotans in the worst global pandemic in 100 years. Although this particular bill addresses the shortcomings of our systems, it addresses the COVID vaccine in particular, it also goes to start to the heart of our general problem, and that is standing a better system of care that is more just, equitable, and accessible to all. This bill pushes the boundaries of what we can do to reach more audiences, educate and inform more peoples, and it is a basic service we must do, even do better. Minnesotans deserve a world-class system which is accessible, and I want to share with you a personal story. Last week, my father fell ill very quickly and had to go stay in the ER unexpectedly. I was absent from the legislature for a whole week. Our family was not sure if it was COVID-related, but the stress and uncertainty of having a loved one in emergency care at this time is incredibly heart-wrenching. My father has had chronic health issues the last couple of years, and he is much more vulnerable to this virus. He has limited mobility and speaks little English. When I think of issues of health equity, equal access and treatment to language access and outreach, I think of people like my father. We must always do better and strive to do the best for those least able among us. To me, health equity is not only good public policy, it's also very personal. This year's census will show us that our immigrants and refugee communities in general and our communities of color have grown by leaps and bounds. And it's our duty to serve them better, represent them more, and reach more of them where they are. We have people in all stages of life and economic status, and we must reach all of them no matter what state they are in life. We must take bold measures to address our situation to ensure we come out at the end of this tunnel with the greatest amount of life and light intact as a society and as a political system. I hope you join me in supporting and passing this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Zhang. We really appreciate your hard work on this, and thank you for sharing your very personal circumstance, and our hearts go out to you. We wish your dad and your family all the best in dealing with the situation. Okay, so with that, we will now turn to our testifiers. First, we're gonna have Commissioner Malcolm from the Minnesota Department of Health. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today to speak to the importance of House File 2313. And I want to thank the co-authors, Representative Morrison, Representative Zhang, for laying out the case so clearly. As both representatives have said, COVID has shown a brighter light on what have been systemic health inequities in our state for decades and generations. and has even exacerbated those disparities. I just want to share with you that this is a commitment deeply shared by the Minnesota Department of Health. Colleagues at the department have been working to raise visibility of health inequities literally since the early 1990s. And we were proud to sponsor one of the first bills in the nation to fund a really robust effort to address health disparities with the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative, which was passed in 2001 and continues to this day. But yet we would be the first to agree with the observation that not nearly enough progress has been made. So along comes COVID, which, as has been mentioned, further exacerbated the inequities that already existed, not only in health, but in other measures that the administration has been committed to tracking. At MDH, we've made it a priority to be sure that we do publicly report the reality of the disproportionate impact of COVID on certain populations. And it's already been mentioned here, but the degree of the disproportionate impact is truly shocking. And you can see this on our daily and weekly MDH webpage, that we've calculated age-adjusted rates per 100,000 people. And the age adjustment is critical because that sort of normalizes the fact that the demographics are different. And what you see when you look at those data are case incidents, hospitalizations, ICU hospitalizations, and deaths as much as 5 and 6 and 7 times higher for certain disproportionately affected populations than is true for the white population. So these disparities are measurable, they're real, and they are persistent. We also have begun more recently, we've been publishing these age-adjusted statistics by race and ethnicity since early in the pandemic. More recently, we've been able to fill in some of the gaps in the data on vaccination as well. And we know that despite their disproportionate disease burden, populations in these focused communities, including Black, American Indian, Latinx, Asian Pacific Islanders, as well as other metrics of focused communities around disability, low income, and so forth, that we know that those populations, particularly with respect to race and ethnicity in this case, are not getting vaccinated at the same rate as their share of the population, whereas the white population is being vaccinated at a higher rate than the white population's share of the total Minnesota population. That's partially but not completely explained by the fact that the populations in the first eligibility categories, healthcare workers and residents of long-term care, were disproportionately white. But as the eligibility categories open up, we need to see and should be held accountable for closing those gaps in who is being vaccinated to account for the vulnerability of negative outcomes given COVID exposure, but also, as we've just talked about, the disproportionate outcomes that occur when people are exposed. They have higher rates of severe disease and poorer outcomes. So vaccination of these populations is urgent. So what are we doing about it? Well, I'm happy to tell you that what you see in House File 2313 is highly consistent with the input that we've been getting from communities and community leaders along. And so the bill reflects some of what we agree are best practices for improving the allocation of allocation and delivery of vaccine. Fundamentally, there's two things we need to do. We need to make sure that the vaccine is available to disproportionately affected populations, that the vaccine is being deployed to the right places, the right providers, and in a way that is accessible to the populations. But we also need, and the bill points this out as well, to support members of these focus communities to take advantage of the vaccine opportunity when it is there by making sure they have accurate information from trusted resources and the support needed to get them to the vaccine opportunity. So what we've been doing, much as the bill directs, is allocating vaccine doses specifically to those healthcare providers, local public health agencies, community pharmacies, and others who serve these populations and who serve geographies with higher social vulnerability index. We are also working with community-based organizations to fund a network of COVID community coordinators and connectors who are helping to advise on where there should be community vaccination sites and with education and outreach through trusted community leaders and through cultural media and other forms to get the word out. But the bill calls for us to do these efforts, to continue and to build on these efforts, including through a staff of people who lead these efforts at the department, including the creation of a senior leadership position to be the overall leader of this effort. We do have some really talented folks at the health department in our Center for Health Equity and a very large branch of people working with cultural, faith, and disability communities in our vaccine response specifically. I'm really pleased to tell you, I know many of you are aware of this, but Dr. Nathan Chomolo is, I believe, with us in this hearing today. And Dr. Chomolo, who you may know is the Medicaid Medical Director at the Department of Human Services, is also going to be sharing some of his time with us at MDH to serve as our senior vaccine equity leader. And I'm just really grateful for his expertise and his time. And so what we are very much in support of this bill. We appreciate so much the committee's time and the co-authors work with us on this. We would like to do, just as Representative Zhang, I think, very well explained, to also use this bill as an opportunity to not only continue and build further on the efforts around the COVID vaccine, which are going to be ongoing for some time, as we know, but Dr. Chomolo has some great ideas about how do we kind of take these learnings and expand that into other vaccination efforts and other health equity efforts going forward. And so with that, Madam Chair, with your permission, I would love for Dr. Chomolo to be able to introduce himself to the committee.
Certainly. Thank you, Commissioner. Dr. Chomolo, welcome. Did you want to say a few words?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Commissioner, for the introduction. Really looking forward to working with the Department of Health in this role and really appreciate the legislation that's been brought forward that is going to really help continue to support the need to prioritize equity in our response. I think there's a number of ways that we can continue to improve, whether it's from measuring our methods that we're using right now and what is their impact to developing a equity metric that can stand up alongside, not in place of, but alongside the need to do this quickly. And so that we're not only focusing on speed. And then, yeah, I 100% want to, highlight what Representative Zhang was really touching on and Representative Morrison touched on. And that this is really an opportunity to both look at the ways we've engaged with community to address structural and social drivers of health, but also then as we make these investments to improve our COVID-19 response, how do we continue that and not stop just when COVID-19 is done, but continue to address these longstanding barriers to care? And so I really am excited about this opportunity to step into this role and just want to thank the committee for hearing this bill and for the support it will give to this important work.
Well, thank you, Dr. Chomolo. I'm excited that you have agreed to step into this role and looking forward to engaging with you and learning more about how we can help and partner to make this more and more a reality. So with that, we're going to then turn to our other testifiers, and we do have quite a long list. And so the first on the list is Dr. Lixon. And Dr. Lixon, welcome to the committee. And if you would just, and all the testifiers, just state your name and who you're affiliated with, and then go ahead and give us your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Hannah Lixon, and I'm here today to speak in support of House File 2113 as both a physician advocate and on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. I'm joined today by Linnea, who is 7 and playing hooky from her math class at the moment. So this bill creates a foundation upon which we in Minnesota can do crucial work. And I'd like to show you why I did share some graphs in the materials that were sent to you. As you know, the COVID pandemic has not affected all Minnesotans equally. Based on data from the Minnesota Department of Health as of last week, compared with white Minnesotans, Black, Asian, American Indian, Latinx, and mixed race Minnesotans have died at age-adjusted rates of between 2.5 and 6 times higher. Despite communities of color being the most likely to become ill and die during this pandemic, our initial vaccination efforts have left them out. While white people comprise about 81% of the adult population in our state, they've received 91% of the vaccines so far allotted. In contrast, Minnesotans of color have been vaccinated at disproportionately lower rates. The reasons for this disparity are multifactorial, but they're largely related to access. In fact, recent polling showed that Black adults are more likely to want the vaccine than white adults. So we know that the disparities in Minnesota cannot be explained by so-called vaccine hesitancy. We also know that these disparities aren't new. In Minnesota, we've been working to address racial disparities in vaccine use for decades, but despite this, still have significant disparities in vaccination rates between white and other children. And this is why HF2113 is so important. Systemic disinvestment in Black, Asian, Indigenous, Latinx, and disability communities is why these Minnesotans have been so disproportionately harmed by this virus. And so our response to these disparities has to be systemic in return. This bill creates a framework for investing in these communities through improved targeted education and access to the vaccine. It also allows us to establish clear equity metrics for evaluating our success in vaccine equity in addition to speed of vaccination. Also, given the longstanding inequities in vaccination rates in Minnesota, I, along with the AAP, ask that the Director of Vaccine Equity will become a permanent position at the Department of Health to continue this important work even after the COVID pandemic has resolved. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lixon. And just so members know, Dr. Lixon sent us some slides which were emailed out to members. You would have just gotten them recently in your email if you want to check that out, some of the data that she's discussing here today. Next on the agenda is Ellen Armendariz Stumbo. I hope I said that right. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ellen Armendariz Stumbo, and I'm a parent of 2 disabled children. I'm testifying in support of HF2113, as I have seen firsthand how difficult it is for individuals in our Latinx community impacted by disability to access the vaccinations. I'm a member of a Spanish-speaking group connected to the Down Syndrome Association of Minnesota. And when parent caregivers became eligible to receive the vaccine, it became apparent to me that many in the group were unaware that they were eligible. I have spent the last 3 weeks working with nearly 25 people to help connect them to vaccines. And I've noticed 3 critical access barriers. Technology. Not everyone has access to the internet. When they call for information about vaccination, they're referred to an internet link or online sign up without the possibility of actually signing up over the phone. Language. While there is some information available in Spanish, it is not easy to access. As an example, while the information on the Minnesota Department of Health website is in Spanish, once you click to sign up, you are taken to an English page with only the option to fill out the form in English. And I just checked this morning and that continues to be the case. So there is no easily accessible link to a Spanish form. There's education. People don't know details about the vaccine and not much education is available in Spanish. They wonder if it's safe. They wonder why some in their family qualify and others don't. Even some of the questions in the forms that they're filling out in Spanish are hard for them to fill out unless someone is walking with them question by question, which I have done with several individuals. In addition, many of the families that I have helped, they live in multifamily or multi-generational homes. And it has been unclear when people with disabilities, their caregivers, and their family members living with them are eligible for the vaccine. Adding to the problem is fear. I've talked with several individuals to assure them they will not be asked about their immigration status when they get the vaccine. I support HF 2113 because it has a variety of strategies to break down barriers I have witnessed firsthand in our Latinx community. And with significant resources coming from the federal government, I do hope our Department of Health can systemically break down these barriers and that those in my community can have equitable access to the vaccines and other resources critical for public health. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today in support of this bill.
All right, well, thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate you being here. Next is Nikki Villavicencio. Nikki, welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Nikki Villavicencio. I live in Maplewood with my partner, Daryl, and our soon-to-be 9-year-old daughter, Allie. Primarily, I live my life on the floor using my feet for everything. Otherwise, I roll around my community in an electric wheelchair. My life's work has been greatly influenced by my experience as a disabled person, but also as a Filipinx. Social justice, equity and inclusion trainings and workshops are just a couple of the things I have worked on in the last 10 years. Thank you, Representative Jay and Representative Morrison, for bringing this issue to light. As a disabled mother and partner to a disabled man trying to understand the ups and downs and uncertainty that COVID has put us all in has only exacerbated our already complex lives. As a disability rights advocate, this year has been desperately challenging. We hear from disabled people every day who want to know when they will be able to receive their vaccination, how to sign up, how are they going to get there, how long does it take, will the bus be waiting for them? In House File 2113, Section 2, Subdivision 4, Community Assistance, the bill states that someone will help arrange for and prepare to obtain a COVID-19 vaccine and support transportation limited members of the communities with transportation. This measure does not go far enough to meet the needs of the disability community or the BIPOC community. We need coordination with Metro Mobility, Metro Transit, and cultural centers. Metro Mobility will likely need to temporarily adjust their policies to accommodate riders. We need an ability to buy bus passes for people who are unable to afford another ride that month. We need to ensure that all vaccination locations are safe, accessible, and near a bus stop. We need culturally competent workers assisting who understand disability, but also understand why some groups of our community have hesitation around vaccines. Section 3, mobile vaccination program. The bill here states that there will be at least one mobile vaccination location in our 8 regional healthcare coalitions. This way of rolling out the vaccine is a great idea, but once again, if we are truly doing things equitable, we need far more coordination than this bill calls for. We must plan for the worst weather and hope for the best. If people are waiting in lines, there must be dry, warm places to sit down. Scheduling windows need to be more accurate for transportation. Otherwise, many people will wait. Will the mobile locations be located at any cultural centers and or independent living centers? Section 4, planning and data. Much of the struggle that leaders in the disability community have been facing is the lack of data on disability. In order to ensure that the future people of color and people with disabilities are accurately being served, we must obtain and use this data. Section 5, Director of Equity Outreach. It is imperative that the director have a good understanding of disability, county and state services. Disability is intersectional, and our Department of Health should reflect that. Section 6, COVID-19 Vaccine Allocation Advisory Group. This bill adds a person who has expertise in disinformation. As we address some of the equity issues today, I would urge you to add another member of the advisory group who has a wide range of experiences on disabilities. The group currently has only one disability representative. It cannot be said more. Disability is intersectional. We need to create a vaccination system that centers the most marginalized Minnesotans. Thank you for listening to me today. I will stay for questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Villavicencio. Really appreciate your attention to all this and your information today. Next on our list is Dr. Eduardo Medina. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Eduardo Medina. I'm a full-spectrum family practice physician with a master's in public health, trained in practicing in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to add my voice and experience to the many healthcare professionals, public servants, community leaders, patient advocates, and common sense observers calling for improvements in how we address the COVID-19 pandemic in Minnesota. From the outset, many of us recognize that the SARS-CoV-2 virus does not discriminate between immigrants or those of us born within the borders of the United States, detained or free of state custody, poor or privileged, with chronic illness or disability or without, or those who must physically show up for work and those who have accommodations. From the outset, we have advocated for following the data and the guidance of epidemiologists to prioritize infection control and prevention. This unfortunately was not done, and at the end, and the end result is that in Minnesota, Black, Indigenous, and Latino patients disproportionately contracted and died from COVID-19. As most recent data revealed, profound racial disparities in age-adjusted excess mortality rates for whites are exceeded by 2.8 to 5.3 times for all other racial categories, most severely amongst Black, Latino, and Indigenous Minnesotans. And to no one's surprise, we see these inequities replicated in vaccine distribution, where the individuals within the age groups and communities with the most disparate COVID mortality have limited access to immunizations. This legislation, I believe, would give us impetus and guidance to the many organizations and healthcare systems trying to address these disparities. I'd like to leave you with two final impressions. An effective COVID pandemic response is an equitable pandemic response. Anything short of this is harmful and puts all of our communities at risk. Secondly, for all of the changes that we've been through during this pandemic, it is disheartening but illustrative that we have not been able to dismantle the political and societal structures that devalue and disregard the suffering of Black, Indigenous, and Latino Minnesotans, many of whom I've cared for and some of whom I've lost throughout this pandemic. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Medina. Appreciate your testimony. Bryce Maples, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bryce Maples. I am a Minnesotan with a disability and a board member of Our Stories, Our Health. I've come to speak with you about my own experience getting vaccinated and the massive issues and disparities in Minnesota's vaccination efforts. I live in Minneapolis, where I'm lucky enough to have access to public transportation and through buses and the light rail. I'm a Fairview patient and am able to get vaccinated because of my physical disability. I only actually learned that by chance because despite being signed up for the vaccine connector, I never received any form of notification that my disability was added to this list. When I went to Fairview's website to try to find, when I went to the Minnesota Department of Health's website to try to find a location, I found that Fairview only had one location in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, and that it was not accessible to me as a person with a disability who uses public transit. Their facility simply did not have access for people with disabilities. Things like this could be prevented by a specific staff person at the Department of Health as it issued in HF 2113. But as spoken by other witnesses, this is not nearly enough. I would just like to, I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to hit on one other thing. As we've heard, once controlled for age, you can see these huge disparities. And we're hearing that the age groups and the division of the groups and the aging disparities are a justification or at least a reasoning for these massive racial disparities. The fact that these initial vaccination groups skewed so heavily white is not a justification, it's an indictment of the grouping and the ways that they were grouped. I hope that this bill will help the Department of Health move forward in a more equitable and inclusive way. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Maples. Maren Halden, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members. My name is Maren Halden. I'm an attorney at Legal Aid, which includes the Minnesota Disability Law Center. I did note just in advance of this hearing that I would be willing to submit written testimony instead of oral testimony because there are so many other wonderful speakers today. So I'll just point members to Legal Aid's letter and support. We are very strongly in support and grateful for the incredible work that all the other testifiers are doing to advance and advocate for racial equity and disability equity in vaccines. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you, Ms. Halden. And we'll ask members to take a look at that letter. Okay, Kai-Ying Yang, is next.
Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kai-Ying Yang. I am the Director of Programs at the Coalition of Asian American Leaders. We are a network of over 4,000 Asian Minnesotans working on community priorities to ensure equity is achieved for all. I am testifying in support of HF 2113. The Asian Minnesotan population in the is over 270,000 with 40 different ethnic groups speaking more than 100 languages, each experiencing COVID-19 in a unique and negative way. We are also the current COVID-19 crisis, a very dangerous form of racism and xenophobia. We support HF 2113 because we have witnessed how non-English speakers have to wait weeks longer to access COVID testing due to the lack of translation and interpretation. We urge you to consider communities' long-term needs for bilingual and bicultural staff. We want to work with the Director of Equity to improve statewide collection of disaggregated data. We hear over and over that precise data about our communities does not exist or is of poor quality. As a whole, Asian Americans in Minnesota only make up 5% of the population, yet they represent 6% of all COVID hospitalizations and 8% of COVID ICU cases. In Ramsey County, where the largest Hmong community resides, Asian Americans represented 18% of COVID cases and 16% of the deaths, the highest percentage for any population of color. And despite being 5% of Minnesota's population, only 3% of the Asian Minnesotans have been vaccinated. Current data collection practices obscures the great disparities within these populations and prevents health officials and policymakers like you from making sound data-driven decisions to allocate resources to meet the unique needs of each distinct community. Equity cannot be realized if the policies in HF 2113 are not implemented. And until significant changes are made, our communities will continue to be invisible to policymakers. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this important bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Yang. We appreciate it. Next we have Monica Maria Hurtado.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Monica Maria Hurtado, and I am a racial justice and health equity organizer for Voices for Racial Justice. I am testifying in support of the HF 2113 because I have seen all the barriers and challenges around health and around health and racial disparities now only exacerbated with the COVID pandemic. I am an immigrant myself. I am from Colombia, where I was trained as a family medicine doctor. For the last 7 years, I have worked with Voices for Racial Justice, but before I worked in a community clinic in South Minneapolis for 12 years. And let me say that it has been a very challenging journey to see how living in the richest country of the history of the world and in a state that is one of the most prosperous of the nation, I still hear the stories of immigrant members dying at home out of fear of going to the emergency room and getting an expensive bill, or the story of my Latinx friend who is a nurse sharing with me that she has spent her entire Sunday in a line helping one of her friends to get a vaccine in a community clinic in North Minneapolis. When she arrived at 8:20 a.m., The line had more than 100 people already waiting. She has been spending entire Saturdays volunteering to vaccinate people. And she has also seen how even in a community clinic, the most of the community members coming to be vaccinated have been white, because the ways the outreach has been happening is through my chart, through internet, and that has been an issue for people of color to know how to get to the vaccination places. So we at Voice for Racial Justice are in support of this bill. We think it's a step in the right direction, and all the provisions that have been already named are a great step. Still much more work to be done, and we are so grateful for the opportunity to be here with you today and to continue to, advocating for these incredible and great opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hurtado, for your testimony. We appreciate that. Okay, Imam Azad Zaman, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, I am Imam Azad Zaman, Executive Director of the Muslim American Society of Minnesota and a leader with ISAIAH. I bring your attention to the vaccine equity issue in the Muslim community. It appears that more than 50% of eligible Muslims are not vaccinated yet. And the recent mobile vaccine clinic at the Cedar Riverside area seems to have made a significant difference in that one neighborhood. Furthermore, as more and more people relax and let down their guard, we know that social distancing and mask requirements are no longer being rigorously followed. And add to that, the Muslim month of Ramadan is starting in 21 days on April 13th. And I am deeply worried that unless proactive measures are taken, we may see a spike in infections. As you know, in Ramadan, there is a special night prayer called the Taraweeh prayer that lasts about 90 minutes each night. That happens 2 hours after iftar. You know, iftar, when we invite all the guests and they leave, and that's when the prayer begins. This special Ramadan prayer might become a significant source of contagion unless urgent steps are immediately taken. So far, my community has been offered 2 half-day vaccine clinics on April 7th for 500 doses each. This is a good first step, but is definitely not enough. Our proposed solution is to set up 10 mosques to be vaccination centers. Ideally, we need these clinics to start on April 1st. I know the state is targeting the end of April as the day when vaccines will be available to everyone in Minnesota. The only accommodations we are requesting is to make that supply a few weeks early for our community during the timing of Ramadan, and to designate some mosques as vaccination centers. This proposal could be properly facilitated by a director of vaccine equity. And so we give a special thank you to Representative Morrison and Representative Shong for their leadership on this bill. And thank you to committee members for approving this bill. A deadly virus shows that what our faith teaches us, that we are all connected. We are asking for this accommodation, not as a special treatment for our community, but in recognition of this basic truth. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Good to see you. Okay, next on our agenda is Vazong Moa. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. My name is Vazong Moa, and I'm the Director of Racial and Health Equity Advocacy at Blue Cross and Blue Shield. I wanted to quickly honor the insights and wisdom of the previous testifiers as well. I'm here to express strong and clear support for House File 2113. We know that racism is a public health crisis. We know this through science. We know this through generations of community experience. I could easily cite the New England Journal of Medicine, and I can also cite my grandmother and my parents' experience as well. I wanna just be clear that COVID-19 is permeated with racism from upstream factors in exposure, infection, treatment, deaths, and most notably in vaccine distribution as well. This bill at its heart embeds racial and intersectional equity analysis and priority into the distribution plan and into key decision-making processes. I want to just quickly lift up a couple key elements. The formation of the equity director role is essential to embedding racial and intersectional equity into governance, into ongoing leadership, into ongoing oversight and accountability. So I really want to highlight the importance of that. And I look forward to working with Dr. Chomolo, to MDH, and with all of you to make sure that there's strong equity implementation throughout the process. The other key element I want to lift up is around equitable vaccine distribution and mobile vaccines. Blue Cross has already embarked on a volunteer mobile vaccine program with MDH. And I want to make sure that the onus of vaccination isn't on the communities experiencing inequities, but that the state and us collectively are designing for equitable distribution. We want to make sure that we're not treating communities as hard to reach, but recognize that they are hardly reached. And that begins with making sure that we send out teams with the cultural capacity and the trust to meet communities where they are. This bill strengthens, connects, and systematizes good momentum and efforts underway. I want to ask for your strong support for House File 2113, and thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mr. Moi. And that phrase will stick with me, hard to reach, not hard to reach, hardly reached. Very, very well said. Thank you. And we have Jaime Martinez. Welcome.
Thank you. I just had a pop-up come up on my window here. Hold on, please. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jaime Martinez, and I am representing the Minnesota Public Health Association, or the acronym is MPHA. It is a 100-year-old professional association comprised of over 430 public health professionals, healthcare providers, advocates, and students dedicated to the health of all people in Minnesota. Our mission is to create a healthier Minnesota through effective public health practice and engage citizens. I am testifying today in strong support for House File 2113. MPHA is acutely aware of the significant and longstanding disparities in health outcomes among American Indians and other populations of color in Minnesota and elsewhere across the country. These inequities and health disparities are evidenced most recently in the higher rates of illness and death in our American Indian and populations of color due to COVID-19 pandemic. And on the MDH website, you can see some of that data and some of those outcomes due to the pandemic. MPHA also recognizes the severe impact of racism on the well-being of Minnesotans and has taken a strong position by declaring racism is a public health crisis through a member-endorsed resolution. We have also worked with various partners in the state to ask Governor Walz to declare that racism is a public health crisis. The current bill provides the structure necessary to assure equal access to vaccines for American Indians, other populations of color, and those who are at high risk of COVID-19. It also, to the exuberance of our organization, provides for collection of data that includes race, ethnicity, and language. Though MDH has been doing some of this work already, the bill provides for how to better collect some of this data, to desegregate it and look at granular data, which is very critical because it provides a better picture of what is happening in communities and it allows for quality improvement going forward. The bill is an important step to prevent ongoing inequities in vaccine access and thus it engages community in a good way. I really appreciate the time and opportunity to testify, and I'll remain on the call for any questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Martinez. And then we have Dr. Alex Harsha Bangura.
Hello. Thank you for having me. My name is Dr. Alex Harsha Bangura. I'm a family medicine physician in Todd County.
And Dr. Bangura, we're having a little trouble hearing you, if you can speak a little bit louder. Thank you.
Yes, sorry. I'm a family medicine physician in Todd County and a rural health equity fellow with the AAFP. I'm testifying in support of House File 2113 and here to highlight the importance of bringing vaccine equity to BIPOC communities in rural Minnesota. Rural Minnesotans face higher COVID case and death rates, and as you've heard from the others testifying today, this risk is compounded many times over for BIPOC people due to high-risk work environments like meatpacking, as well as longstanding racial bias. In May, I led a COVID response program at the largest local meatpacking plant in my county, which has a 95% Hispanic workforce.
Ultimately, 40% of the workforce tested positive, and the public health department called it a success. Many workers exceeded their paid leave due to prolonged illness, repeated quarantines. Some were hospitalized, another miscarried. At the end of July, Todd County had the worst COVID inequity in the entire country, with Hispanic people testing positive at rates more than 40 times whites. And this inequity persists today. It was not unavoidable. There were insufficient resources to prevent and respond to these outbreaks, with inadequate case surveillance programs, too few bilingual contract tracers, and limited oversight of these employers, the very same who benefited from historically high profit margins and protections under the Defense Production Act. Under the state's current guidelines, meatpacking workers are getting prioritized for the protection they need and they deserved long ago. However, the full risk of COVID is borne by the larger community through family and household exposure. For example, in Nobles County, family members of meatpacking employees had nearly five times higher rates of infection than those who were not connected to this industry. We must expand eligibility to all BIPOC people, regardless of age or comorbidity, increase accessibility by bringing vaccines access directly to homes, high-risk workplaces, and BIPOC community spaces in rural Minnesota. And we must adequately fund and monitor our progress towards achieving equitable vaccine coverage for these vulnerable communities. House File 2113 provides the framework for doing this, and I urge you to join us in support of this effort. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Bangura. We appreciate it. Thank you for your work out there in Todd County. Okay, so we are going to go to member questions here, but I see Dr. Chamillo, you have your hand up. Did you want to make a brief comment before we go to member questions?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. After seeing all these wonderful testifiers, I understand that I didn't do a great job introducing myself as far as where I'm coming from and lead to this role. And so if it's all right, I would just ask for a couple minutes to do that.
Well, if you could, try to be really brief because we do need to give members a chance to ask a few questions.
Yes, sorry. Thank you. Super brief. I'm a pediatrician and internist who for the last year served half-time in clinic as well as the Medicaid medical director for DHS. I came to that role after doing lots of advocacy in early childhood and also co-founding Minnesota Doctors for Health Equity, which is a statewide coalition focused on health equity. And so it's through these lenses that I really bring to this role. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, I've also served on the Minnesota COVID Ethics Collaborative, as well as MDH's Vaccine Allocation Advisory Work Group. And so I really appreciate all the testifiers and I'm really looking forward to connecting with you and moving forward in this work.
Thank you, Dr. Chamillo. And we're really glad you're here with us today and that you're going to be in this role. And there have been so many good ideas mentioned and thoughts given on some things that are more specific and others more general. And I know you and others on the call are paying close attention to capture more. You know, all of us know only what we know. And it's great to have all of this input so that we can hear from people whose experience we might not exactly share. So I think this has been just wonderful. Thank you to all the testifiers. We're going to go to, I know Representative Munson, you had your hand up earlier. Did you want to have a question before I go to Representative Quam? Okay, I don't hear him. So why don't we go to Representative Quam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And listening to the testifiers, it reminds me that we've got a multitude of different programs that we've tried over the years. Some of the testifiers said we need to monitor and results. And frankly, I don't think we've been getting a lot of results on the disparities and inequity. And we need to leverage the councils, the other entities, some of those that were represented in the testifiers, and get results. If something's not working, get that feedback, step up and try and, you know, either fix it, better fund it, or replace it with something that might, because it's long past, the time when we require results. And we're talking about things. One of the things that I'm familiar with, for a while, I lived in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and participated in a program where we would go into neighborhoods. Generally, it was a park. Sometimes it was a facility. And we would have vaccinations, exams, give children screenings, things that are often overlooked. And part of that was by partnering with local public health people, but organizations that knew that and could get the word out. And the second day, we always had more people. And I'm just confused as to if we're having trouble reaching some of the communities, why MDH and DHS don't have existing partnering with the local public health and the community organizations to where we, as soon as this pandemic started, that we weren't already organizing and having things scheduled to try and address some of those issues. And, you know, in the bills and the stuff I've been reading, there are mobile clinics. And frankly, by the time things get past the purchasing process, we're going to be pretty close to when we would have to, it's our goal to have vaccinations done, not too long from now. And so that when we look at these things, we need to make sure that they're capable of long-term impact to improve health outcome and other health disparities. So if we're going to get a mobile vaccination vehicle clinic, make sure that it's capable of, it being used for exams, for vaccinations, maybe even for some dental, so that it's more versatile, and it could then be, we could have regular activities in the different counties and different locations so that they get used to, it's June, so they're going to have this the first weekend or second weekend. So we build that long-term lasting impact so that we're going to be spending one-time funds, but we can leverage that to make a difference and get results. We've promised great, wonderful future results. I'm hoping that with this bill and others, what we need is the people need results today, students, children, families, communities. And I hope as things are put together and you get your budget allotment that we look at that long-term leverage of the one-time funds. But I was wondering if the author of the bill maybe had a couple of things to say about how this will be different than in the past, whether the built-in monitoring or et cetera. So that's I've got great hope, but I just worry that we won't leverage. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Quam. I don't know who would answer that, but I'm going to go to the next, maybe somebody can be thinking about how to answer that. Maybe we can do that in the wrap up. Representative Keel.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the time to ask questions. First of all, I have some real concerns with public health. We have public health that are supposed to be handling this. Measles, TB, they handle all those things. So they know the constituency, correct, or should to some degree. I realize that we have big, big counties. But maybe the commissioner, if she's still around, I didn't see if she's here. But I'm wondering, with those services, do we, great points were made by our testifiers. Absolutely great points. Are we not already handling technology and language and education? I realize that the fear portion of this is over a lot of population. Doesn't matter what nationality you are, there are some real concerns about, do I get the vaccination? How will it affect me? And all of the conversation that's out there about vaccinations. But what I would like to know is, with our public health, do we already provide some of those concerns, and are we taking care of our population?
So Commissioner Malcolm, I don't know if she's still on this call. And I don't know if Representative Zhang or Representative Morrison wants to try to address that. I guess I think what we heard is that the department is doing some of this, but it's not enough. That's what I think I heard. Representative Morrison, do you want to weigh in here?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Keel. I think what Chair Liebling just said is accurate. You know, we're looking at a situation where our public health has been chronically underfunded, and it was hit by a global pandemic. And on top of the existing structural inequities that we have in Minnesota, this is the problem that we're dealing with now. So some of the idea is to bolster those and to do more of it. MDH is absolutely doing some of it, but no more needs to be done. And I think our testifier spoke very eloquently to that, as did Representative Zhang.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yeah,
I'll make this quick.
Yeah,
so the concern is things like metro mobility or just getting somebody to that vaccination, regardless of what their challenges are. We have some of that opportunity. I'm just wondering, are we taking the money and dividing it rather than enhancing what we already have, helping our public health to make sure that we have those contacts, that we make sure that disabilities can get there, whether it's in their car or able to get into the facility? My bigger concern is, are we spending money developing another program when in fact we should just be enhancing? Maybe I misunderstood the bill, but that's what my concern is we're developing more rather than enhancing what is already available and helping them to be more successful so that we can get those vaccines out.
Representative Morrison, do you want to try and address that?
Madam Chair and Representative Keel, I think it's a yes and situation. You know, I think part of what the bill is getting at is working with some of the structures that we already have in place, bolstering those and improving them and adding more. So I don't know that we're necessarily reinventing the wheel, but we clearly need to do better and we need to do more. And I think that the hire of Dr. Chamalo is a huge step in that direction. This is urgent. Time is a wasting and we got to get busy.
All right. Thank you. Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just also wanted to thank Representative Morrison and Representative Zhang for their work on this bill and bringing this forward, and as well as the testifiers today. This has been really powerful and meaningful, and so thank you to all of their work on this as well. My question, I think, was probably to Commissioner Malcolm, and I don't know that she's still here, but maybe somebody from Department of Health can follow up, or I can follow up with them. But I'm wondering, knowing that there are systemic inequities built in our healthcare systems. And I say that as somebody who is part of that system. We need systemic changes. I'm curious as to the more permanent changes or things that are being done in this space. And one example of that would be Dr. Chamalo's position, if that will be temporary or permanent. And so just wondering about what are we doing now, but also to sustain things moving forward. So maybe I can get some follow-up on that later.
Yeah. And I know we do have, I think that the commissioner had to hop off, but we do have other MDH staff. But I know I do think that what we're doing from here out is going to be a big, big question. There is no question that our public health system has been underfunded for many, many years. We don't have the infrastructure we need. And it's my hope, and I think, you know, I hope we're going to do a lot this year. And the, you know, in the bill, there's now an appropriation that's a little bit not nailed down tightly exactly what, but this is a work in progress. But to really continue to build our public health infrastructure so that we are prepared to reach and really serve all of these communities and have those structures in place in ways that obviously has not been fully happening, so that we don't have to quickly, you know, reinvent this when there's a problem, but that a lot of what public health does, as we all know in this committee, is try to, you know, is try to deal with these things before they become even big issues, to try to have structures in place to keep people healthy and to help them be able to be healthy. So, you know, it's a big dream that we can take this terrible situation for so many and make it into something that really builds for the future. I would like to go now to Representative Zhang. If you would like to say a few words as we finish up here, that would be great. And then I'll go to Representative Morrison, and then we'll lay the bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and committee members, let's make the vaccine more accessible to everyone, regardless of race, class, and geography. Countless barriers due to historical factors and systems, which have left out too many, contribute to a less than equal playing field when it comes to medical care access. I'm hopeful that our efforts to reach more Minnesotans will bear fruit and enable us to come out of this pandemic faster and in a more equitable manner. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Representative Zhang. Representative Morrison, final word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 2113, and thank you to Representative Zhang and to all the testifiers who provided powerful testimony highlighting the urgency of this issue. As several of the testifiers stated, science and anecdotal experience shows us that racism is a public health crisis. This bill can be a step toward working to dismantle Minnesota's racial disparities by urgently addressing access to the COVID-19 vaccine, so that all Minnesotans can be protected. Our interconnectedness has never been more apparent. We can and we must take better care of each other. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you both Representative Morrison and Representative Zhang and all of the testifiers today. So with that, House File 2113 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. We are gonna move now to House File 669, also Representative Morrison. And Representative Morrison, the motion here would be to have House File 669 laid over for possible inclusion. Would you like to move the bill?
I would like to move the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. And please go ahead and present the bill.
Thank you for hearing House File 669 today. This is a bill that improves patient access to healthcare by streamlining provider credentialing. My testifier will explain more about what credentialing is and how it works and why this change is so important. But I do know firsthand that the delay in the credentialing process is harmful.
Oh, Representative Morrison, we lost you there. I think your connection went out. Okay, to my eyes, her image is frozen, so.
This is Brenda Reinhart. Would you like me to step in?
Yes, Ms. Reinhart, why don't you go ahead, just please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brenda Reinhart. I'm the Business Office Manager at Vitreo Retinal Surgery. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Medical Group Management Association's Government Affairs Committee. I'd like to thank Representative Morrison for authoring this bill. Provider credentialing is the process in health plans used to evaluate a healthcare provider's education, training, residency, licenses, and certifications in order for a healthcare provider to provide healthcare services to patients in clinics and a facility and to be reimbursed by the payer. Payer contracts generally do not allow healthcare providers to practice medicine or to see patients while they await the credentialing process. Currently, the process of credentialing a provider varies between health plans and can take anywhere from 60, 90, 120 days or longer to complete. Each payer does this internally and with varying requirements and timelines. This affects patient care as they cannot see the provider during this timeline and they must either wait until the process is completed or find another provider. This is also an administrative burden to healthcare providers and clinics because of the varying processes and lengthy timelines, as they have to track status with each payer and cannot schedule until the provider is approved and given an effective date. The result is that there can be multiple effective dates across payers, which can be a scheduling headache for the clinics as well as the patient. In our fact gathering process, we found many issues with lack of transparency. These issues vary from payer to payer, but we found them across most of the commercial payers here in the state of Minnesota. In the interest of time, I will not go over the examples, but I am happy to submit these in writing if you desire. The Government Affairs Committee started to review and discuss the problems and inequities in the provider credentialing process back in 2016 and collected real-time examples. We've shared these examples with the Council of Health Plans, and they were very sympathetic to our issues. We've had great dialogue with them, and we've gotten them to a place of comfort and understanding with the language in this bill. What this bill does is it's effective in addressing the needs to streamline healthcare providers credentialing across all payers, which everyone involved has agreed is necessary. It creates a definition for provider credentialing, which has never otherwise been defined by legislature. It creates a standard and fair timeline for health plans to complete provider credentialing, which is 45 days from the date a clean application is approved. It outlines what a clean application is and what is done if the health plan determines that an application for the provider credentialing is not deemed clean and provides an additional timeline for that provider to submit the additional information. It also provides a transparent effective date, allowing patients to be scheduled proactively in a reasonable and fair timeline. I would like to thank you, Madam Chair, and also thank you, Representative Morrison, for once again authoring Bill House File 669. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ms. Reinhart. I don't know if Representative Morrison was able to get back on here. She obviously had some connection issues, but
Madam Chair, I'm back on my phone. I apologize.
Very good. Very good, Representative Morrison. So did you want to, I don't see any questions. Let me just see if members have questions. I haven't seen any, but if anyone does. And so Representative Morrison, it was my understanding, and I think Ms. Reinhart just spoke to it too, that there is kind of so-called peace in the valley on this bill. Is that your understanding as well?
Remarkably so, Madam Chair.
Okay.
We have found it.
All right. Very good. That legislative term we like to use, peace in the valley. Okay. Very good. So any final words, Representative Morrison? I'm sorry we lost a little bit of your introduction, but I think Ms. Reinhart stepped up very nicely.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm grateful to Ms. Reinhart for stepping in for me. I apologize for the technical difficulties, but I appreciate the opportunity to hear this bill and hope that we can move it forward to improve patient access by streamlining the credentialing process with the health plans. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. So with that, House File 669 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Reinhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so our final bill on the agenda is House File 2138, and this is Representative Hassan's bill, but I understand she's unable to be with us today. And so Representative Gomez, who's an author on the bill, is here. Thank you so much, Representative Gomez, for stepping in. So that since you're not on the committee, the chair will move House File 2138 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And would you like to present the bill?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. House File 2138 is an appropriation to the Little Earth Residents Association. So LERA, or the Little Earth Residents Association, is the Residents Association, you'll be surprised to find, for Little Earth of United Tribes, which is the only American Indian preference publicly, you know, housing project basically in the country. It has, I have some testifiers who will give a little bit more context about the community. But, you know, it, there are challenges in this community, and they received a burn grant from, I believe, the Department of Justice in, I think it was 2015. I was working at the city at the time. And so it was really about kind of like supporting this community in developing public safety programs that were really rooted in community. And so these kind of took, you know, there was two sort of, the burn grant did a lot more work than that because it was kind of a big chunk of money. So this pares it down to really focus on some of the issues around opioid use and abuse in the community. There in Little Earth, there have been efforts to train everybody in administering naloxone or Narcan, which reverses overdoses. And this has been a place where Little Earth, where there's been a lot of overdoses. So this has been really valuable. The other thing is that there's a community, kind of a community safety ambassador program that this would continue to fund. And so it's, you know, it's really just continuing this work that federal dollars have already supported, sort of setting up this program over the course of the last 5 or 6 years. They've also been working with some Hamline professors, so they have some data about what the impact is, but it's, we're really asking the state to step in to help support these community efforts that are already happening so that they can continue. And with that, I would turn it back over to you, and I have a couple testifiers.
All right, thank you very much, Representative Gomez. So on my list, I have Margarita Ortega. Welcome. If you would just say your name and then tell us who you're representing, and please go ahead and give us your testimony.
Hi, I'm Margarita Ortega. I am the Senior Executive Assistant at Little Earth Resident Association. I am also a Little Earth resident and been following and been a part of this program in which Representative Gomez is talking about, the burn grant. And this grant specifically focuses on our relationships with multiple different jurisdictions within the city, the state, dealing with public safety and being able to have those connections, along with creating community engagement involvement along with that. So it's supposed to be a restorative justice grant that we had, and it worked very well. We created a peacemaking program out of that. It was very effective. And now that it has been, because of everything that has happened within the past, let's say presidency, we ended up losing that funding stream. There was no longer any funding from the Department of Justice for this. And our community has been relying on this program to be able to stay connected to the resources, stay connected to being able to collaborate with law enforcement, being able to collaborate with the city attorney's office. And we want to be able to keep this program going so that we can keep our restorative justice programs along with keeping our community engaged in this, you know, this is the lifeblood of our safety. So I want to be able to express that. Yeah, so thank you. If you have any questions, I'm always.
All right, please stay with us. Thank you for your testimony. Please stay in case we do have some questions. Next, I have Joe Beaulieu. Is that right?
Beaulieu? Hi, yep, welcome. Joe Beaulieu. Hi, I'm the executive director at LERA. My name is Joe Beaulieu. This bill came because me and Margarita were talking with our representative, And we realize that there's just a strong need for more safety, especially coming up as the weather gets nicer. Our residents are worried and they're nervous and they're scared, and we want to make sure that there are some efforts put in place to make them feel safer and protected. And this idea is that the residents themselves can drive the safety initiative. They will take the power into their own hands and be able to feel much more able to do these things on their own and not have to be so reliant on outside agencies to come in and try to like solve these problems for them when the community knows what they need. So we want to be able to offer different trainings to our residents, whether that's more Narcan trainings or CPR, trainings around trauma-informed care, and different things that will really help them help each other. So this small cohort will be able to expand and continue to grow as the years progress. And what else was there? Oh yeah, and then be able to host all these community events with different elected officials and people in public safety so that our residents can feel seen, feel heard, and just be able to feel empowered. And that's what I got for you.
All right, thank you so much for your testimony. Okay, are there questions for members? All right, not seeing any. Representative Gomez, would you care to have the final word?
Sure, I guess I just, you know, Ms. Ortega, I can't remember what your official title is, but I just, you know, I've worked in this community for many, many years, and I just wanna say that, you know, you guys all know what Minneapolis went through last year, and Margarita and her community and her family were up all night, all of those really hard nights in our communities, and they were watching out for everybody. And that's what Margarita does, and that's what so many people in this community, through the course of like being able to come together and work on these issues in collaboration with other people in the community and law enforcement and public officials, they've really built this, you know, they've built a system that really like takes that energy in the community and focuses it in a really important way. And so I guess I just, you know, this has been really important support. This is a very challenged area. This is, you know, what's called a hotspot by the police or whatever, because there are a lot of calls that go there, right? But like, I guess I just think it's so important that we step up to help support them, because this is just the kind of like community effort that we need. It's just the kind of community effort that we're all talking about how we need, like here at the Capitol, the collaboration between impacted communities that, you know, have been, you know, the target of disproportionate policing, but that collaboration directly with the law enforcement that operates in their community is like so important for building safety. And so I really appreciate your consideration. I think this is both, you know, the program historically has been both a health and kind of public safety impacting program, and it will continue to be if we can support it. So thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Gomez. So with that, House File 2138 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Thank you very much. So members, we have reached the end of our hearing today. I think it was, at least for me, a very interesting and often moving hearing. And the next meeting we will have is tomorrow. We're going to start hearing the governor's budget in earnest. So look forward to seeing you all tomorrow. And with that, we are adjourned.